It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's Word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this day back in 1099, that's a long, long time ago, almost 1,000 years ago, Christians came to Jerusalem. They were, well, we come to know them as the Christian Crusaders, and on this day, the church remembers them seizing Jerusalem. Why did they need to seize it in the first place? We're going to answer that question and talk about the so-called First Crusade. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest. He's Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's good to be here. And I would like to say, by the way, that Chris and Elizabeth Allman are from my church in Lincoln, and they're great people.
Oh, good. That's a nice connection there.
Yeah.
What exactly happened on this day back in 1099?
Well, the army that we know as the First Crusade, at least the ones that made it to Jerusalem, probably by the time they got there, numbering somewhere from about 10,000, maybe a little bit more than that, took over the city of Jerusalem. They broke the siege, sacked the city for the next day and a half, which was pretty brutal. And so that's it in a nutshell. They also recognized it was on a Friday. The First Crusade was full of pious visions and portents and so forth, and they did not lose. It was not lost on them that it happened on a Friday because of Good Friday.
So, what were the circumstances that brought them there? Beginning with, what were the circumstances that what occasioned the need to retake Jerusalem?
Well, in 1095, the Pope, Urban II, had called upon Christian knights from the West in late 1095 to go on a pilgrimage, an armed pilgrimage, to go help fight Muslims, mostly Turks, in fact, fighting against the Byzantine Empire in the East, which was a Christian empire. And he also said that they should try to make a pilgrimage to the Jerusalem, which was not an uncommon thing to do then. But it would be an armed pilgrimage by which they would seek to take the city and the land of what I guess we would call the Holy Land back from Muslim, from a Christian point of view, Muslim occupation, and return it. Originally, the idea was to return it to the Byzantine Empire, but things don't always turn out the way they're supposed to originally. So,
is it at this time simply the Turk, or is the Ottoman Empire too early at
this
point?
Yeah, this would have been before the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire would have been another Turkish group that arose later. Mostly, this was the Seljuk Turks. The Seljuk Turks had come into the Middle East. And they had basically taken over large pieces of what today would be Syria, Iraq, Turkey. That's why it gets the name later. But there is one thing to note about these were the main Sunni Muslims. And Jerusalem itself and Palestine, that area, had been taken over by Shia Muslims who were ruling Egypt at the time. So there actually was a Muslim split going on that the Crusaders really had no idea of going into it.
So they were sent for several purposes, and I want to take them apart. One was simply to help what they considered their Christian allies in the Byzantine East.
Correct.
Two, you said an armed pilgrimage. That's kind of a twofold thing here. What was a pilgrimage in 1099?
Yeah, pilgrimages in Christianity actually go way back. We know of pilgrims from as far west as Spain traveling to Jerusalem in the late 4th century. Jerusalem was a site of pilgrimage because of its that's where Pentecost was and where Jesus died and was buried and rose from the dead. Rome later became a big center of pilgrimage in the west. But the main idea in the pilgrimage was to travel to the Holy Sepulchre, the tomb of Christ, to pray there. And by doing that, you would receive, I guess, what we would call today an indulgence, or what became known as an indulgence.
Okay. Now, armed pilgrimage. How did those two things go together in the mind of, in particular, the mind of the man who launched this, the Pope at the time?
Well, right. So part of your duty on this pilgrimage, particularly, was to fight and to defeat who he called the enemies of God. It was clear that he didn't know all the, as I said, the nuance of the divisions in the Muslim world at the time. He talks about the race of Persians, which he basically means the Turks, and these Muslims who were mistreating Christians in the Middle East. There were reports that had come back. He paints this very bleak picture of the way Christians are being treated in very graphic terms. And then the other idea was that the emperor, Alexius I, in Constantinople, had actually sent a messenger to Urban II, the Pope, asking him to perhaps send some mercenary knights. And he had no idea what he was going to get, which was actually an army of about 40,000 that ended up showing up in Constantinople.
So they go there. This is a military conquest, explicitly
correct,
a military conquest, from its inception.
It is, but from their point of view, they were taking back land that belonged to the Byzantine Empire, that had been part of the Christian Byzantine Empire, and they were going to restore it to that Byzantine Empire. As I said, because they accused each other of breaking contracts and oaths, later they kind of founded their own, what are generally called the Crusader States, like the Kingdom of Jerusalem, etc.
Were there... I know we've talked about this before, but my memory doesn't serve me well enough. Were there explicit promises made by Pope Urban about indulgence for participation in this First Crusade?
Well, what he promised them was the remission of all penance for all contritely confessed sins. And what that meant at the time was... in order to show you were really sorry for your sins, you had to do something really, some act of penance. It could include, you know, fasting, ultimately joining a monastery, something like that, or going on a pilgrimage. So he really united the idea of a just war, which they believed it was a just war, and a holy war, with the idea of a pilgrimage.
Now, when they, you said that the actual, this taking of Jerusalem is at the end of a siege of Jerusalem.
Right.
How long did that siege take before Jerusalem fell?
Oh, I'm going to guess about a month. The whole venture lasted about 2.5 years. By the time they got to Jerusalem, they had pretty much shored up the coast of the what's called the Levant, which is basically Lebanon and Israel today, Palestine, those areas. And what they were worried about, however, was if they didn't take Jerusalem really quickly, there was an army that was going to come up from Egypt and would crush them. And they do end up dealing with an army, but they do end up taking the city. It's a very religious venture. They actually do kind of a Joshua at Jericho type of deal when they get there, although they don't have a lot of water or food, but they decide we're going to march around the city. I don't think they did it, was it 7 times? But they marched all the way around Jerusalem barefoot, and with the priest and the monks chanting basically a liturgical procession, and before they laid siege to it. That would have been kind of odd, I think, to the people inside of Jerusalem at the time.
Were there Christians living, for lack of a better word, under the Muslim occupation in Jerusalem?
The leader of Jerusalem, the guy was he was a governor for Egypt, basically, because they just controlled that area at that time. Had kicked all the Christians out of Jerusalem because he was worried about them helping the Latin Christians. Bethlehem, which they did go to, you know, isn't that far from Jerusalem, was pretty much a Christian city, and many of those people helped them. There were also some ships that came from, I think, I want to say Venetian, but they might have been Genoan, who came and landed at one of the harbors, which isn't that far, and brought more wood for them to use to build siege engines. They built about, I want to say, four or five siege engines and laid siege to the city in late June.
What happened after the taking of Jerusalem? How did it progress from that point?
Well, they knew that army from the south was going to be coming up, and they do end up going to fight them about a month later, and they beat them at, I think it would be Ascalon, pretty much where the Gaza Strip is today. And that's kind of the borderland for a long time between what becomes known as the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And they established these crusader states over the next, I'd say, 20 years, and the Kingdom of Jerusalem was the largest one. And the first King of Jerusalem was one of the leaders of the First Crusade. In fact, his brother, Godfrey of Bouillon, who was one of the great warriors in history, he was offered the title King of Jerusalem, and he wouldn't take it. He said there's only one king in Jerusalem, and that's Jesus. And he took the title Advocate of the Holy Sepulchre. He died about a year later, and his brother had no qualms about taking the title. So there were kings of Jerusalem after that. Actually, even after Jerusalem fell, there were people and many, many kings in Europe who claimed the title Kings of Jerusalem later.
How long did the retaken states, the Crusade states, and in particular the city of Jerusalem, remain in Latin Western Christian hands from that point?
Well, there were some, I guess if you count Cyprus and Crete, it would be longer, but basically on the land, there were some state there until the late 1290s. With the event surrounding the Third Crusade, Saladin came in and wiped out a lot of the Christian lands. Now, Richard the Lionheart did restore some of that. Then you have other groups coming into the Middle East, like the Mongols and later other Turkish groups. So by the 1290s, pretty much all of the what you think of as the Crusader states are gone.
I want you to clear this up before our conversation concludes, because there's the subtlety of this history, not the facts and the figures, which are fairly well known, but the actual motivations and the ideas at work in the Crusades, in particular the First Crusade, are often lost on people today, because they'll just simply view the Christian Crusades as one long bad idea, and that they were simply aggression under the guise or even based upon a fanatical religious affection.
Right.
How would you correct that very common misconception about the Crusades without saying, oh, the Crusades were a great idea?
Right, right. Oh, well, you know, as historians, you try to understand the people from their time. It's clear that many of the people were deeply motivated by religious beliefs, particularly the idea of the remission of penance. As I said earlier, they really believed and were told, and I think had a decent argument, that they were actually fighting a defensive war, and a just war for that matter. Modern, postmodern people can't really conceive of fighting a war for, quote, religious beliefs, but we fight wars for such things as hard to define as democracy all the time, and I think a person from the 11th and 12th century would think it was really odd that we would fight a war for democracy as opposed to not fighting a war for religion. If religion's the most important thing, why wouldn't we fight a war over it? So that's kind of, you have to get into their way of thinking about it.
So what do you think is the biggest misconception about the Crusades in general that you would like to, as a professor of history, see permanently eradicated from
well,
the classroom?
That it was all but Christians being bad. Were there bad Christians? Certainly. Do I wish the Crusades had never happened as a person? Yeah, probably. But, you know, without Muslim aggression, Crusades would never have happened. And there's all kinds of arguments we can make both ways about that. But, I mean, well, without Muslim aggression, Crusades never happened. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. I don't think many people can disagree with me about that.
Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to talk with Dr. Roland Ziegler of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about 16th century Lutheran and Orthodox dialogue. Lutherans from the 16th century, newly minted Lutherans, talking to Orthodox Christians. What were they talking about? We'll find out tomorrow on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.